Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we consider the strength of the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. Will the Iran nuclear deal pave the way for their involvement in a Syria conference? A tool to hide on the internet.
It's really sort of like a veil that you can kind of open up, almost a cloak of secrecy.
And a look back 50 years when Dylan changed the path of country music. Coming up on The Voice of America. One of President Barack Obama's themes on his East Africa tour has been to encourage governments there to step up the fight against terrorism, especially Islamic terrorism, with one group, Al-Shabaab, in particular. I'm joined here in the studio by International Edition's Jeffrey Young, who has just spoken to an analyst about Al-Shabaab and the terror situation in East Africa. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, Susan. Kathy Henline, a research analyst at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute in London, describes Al-Shabaab as well-organized and spreading its terror across East Africa.
I think it's really a question of the threat that the group poses and how that's evolving at present. What we've seen recently is the group evolving. It no longer poses a threat solely in Somalia. It's actually been moving away from a sort of a more of a territorial focus on that country, and it's moving now, as it comes under more pressure in Somalia, into Kenya. So we're seeing greater numbers of attacks in Kenya and greater emphasis on fundraising and recruitment in Kenya as well. So we're seeing more of a spread in terms of the threat posed by Al-Shabaab across the region.
Now, Al-Shabaab is not operating in a quasi-state capacity, but describe its level of organization.
Well, it does also have some ambitions to act as a form of state authority. So in the areas under its control in Somalia, that's what we're seeing. But as the pressure in that area has increased from AMISOM, the African Union mission in Somalia, we're seeing a different form of organization. So the adaption in terms of tactics is really, it shows that this is a highly organized group. So in terms of fundraising strategies, for example, the diversification into a number of different revenue streams shows that this is very closely coordinated. And, you know, this is a group that is highly organized and we have to take very seriously as a threat to the region. And I think another interesting question is the group's global allegiances. So there's been a lot of speculation that it might actually be considering joining the Islamic State.
Why do we have actions in Kenya? Why is that a target?
When we've seen attacks carried out in Kenya, the group, when it has claimed responsibility for those attacks, it has said that this is a form of payback for Kenya's participation in AMISOM. It currently is one of the main contributors of troops to that military force. So the group asserts that as long as that military participation in AMISOM continues, Kenya will continue to be subject to Al-Shabaab attacks.
What about the governments of the countries of East Africa, Kenya, Somalia? Do they have an active fight against Al-Shabaab and other elements?
They have shown a very active response to Al-Shabaab in that most of the neighboring countries are major contributors to the African Union mission in Somalia. So both Kenya and Ethiopia contribute large numbers of troops to that mission. In terms of the threat that we're now seeing emerging within Kenya, it's the government is adapting to that threat. So beyond responding in the neighboring country in Somalia, it's now having to address the threat of attacks, recruitment, radicalization within Kenya itself. And that approach is evolving. It certainly is taking the threat very seriously. We've seen quite a hard response by the Kenyan government, so a lot of arrests, mass arrests in certain areas. I think would be beneficial now is to see more on the side of sort of countering violent extremism, so trying to address some of the root drivers of radicalization in the areas that are vulnerable.
That was Kathy Henline, research analyst at the Royal United Services Institute in London.
Thanks for reaching out to London to get that interview.
My pleasure, Susan.
President Obama's visit to Ethiopia has not generated as much interest on social media as his previous stop in Kenya. Michael Lippin is here in the studio to tell us why. Michael.
Hi, Susan. Yes, well, you know, one way you can follow President Obama's visit to Ethiopia is through the Twitter account of the U.S. Embassy in Addis Ababa. Its handle is at U.S. Embassy Addis. And, you know, one thing that jumped out at me is that it only has 2,400 followers. By contrast, the U.S. Embassy in neighboring Kenya, where Mr. Obama began his African tour, has 95,000 followers. Another contrast I noted was between the two main hashtags that are being used on Twitter for the Obama visits, hashtag Obama in Kenya and hashtag Obama in Ethiopia. The analytics website Topsy shows that over the past week, hashtag Obama in Kenya has been used 85,000 times, while hashtag Obama in Ethiopia has been used just 10,000 times. Now, this might seem strange considering that Ethiopia's population is more than double the size of Kenya's. So you might think, why doesn't the Obama trip to Ethiopia generate more interest? Well, here's one interesting theory from rights activist Jeffrey Smith of the DC-based Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Organization. Using his handle at Smith_RF Kennedy, he tweeted that the internet penetration in Ethiopia is just 2% of the population, and there's mass state surveillance of those people. Susan?
That's very interesting. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
NASA says that its Kepler mission has found Earth's older and bigger cousin, an exoplanet and star that closely resembles Earth and our Sun. The planet and Sun are part of the Kepler 452 system, which is about 1,400 light years away and located in the constellation Cygnus. The Earth-like exoplanet is located within the star system's habitable zone. That's the area around a star where liquid water could pool on the surface of an orbiting planet. Kepler 452b is also a bit larger than Earth, takes 385 days to orbit its Sun, and is about 5% further from its star than Earth is from the Sun. But since its Sun is 20% brighter and 10% larger than ours, the exoplanet's surface temperature is about the same as ours. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The U.S.-led coalition has launched thousands of bombing runs on Islamic State positions in Syria and Iraq and said it has had some success in halting the militants' advance. But the Islamic State group still controls wide swaths of northern and western Iraq and northern Syria, just across the border from Turkey. Turkey reportedly agreed last week to let U.S. fighter planes use Incirlik Air Base in southern Turkey to launch attacks on Islamic State militants inside Syria. In another significant escalation of its involvement in the battle against the extremist group, Turkey said it has carried out airstrikes on Islamic State targets in Syria. These developments refocus the attention again on Syria as the most important battlefield against the Islamic State group. To that effect, the United Nations envoy for Syria went back to Syria to revive hope in a political settlement. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with some experts about whether the nuclear deal with Iran would pave the way for the U.S. to invite Iran to such a conference to use its influence on the Assad regime. Mohammed, what do experts say about that possibility?
Experts have very different opinions about that eventuality, Sue. For Basma Moumani, an associate professor of political science at the University of Waterloo in Canada, inviting Iran is the most logical step if a different outcome is to be found for the Syrian crisis, as she said.
Hopefully this nuclear agreement allows including the Iranian regime at the table in the conversation, because it is a reality. The number one backer of the Assad regime in money and arms and finances and morale, let alone troops, comes from the Iranian regime. They do need to be at the table to find a solution to the Syrian crisis, and that would do so much more good to the entire regional stability after, again, more than 200,000 killed, millions of internally and externally displaced Syrians. It's, I think, high time that the Americans invest diplomacy by bringing the Iranian regime to the table and discussing what to do about Syria.
But when I asked Hisham Melhem, another Middle East prominent analyst, he was quick to rule out any constructive role for Iran in a potential Geneva III conference, and that's why.
There are people in Washington and maybe in the region who are saying Iran, since Iran is part of the problem, Iran should be part of the solution. I really don't think that this is likely to happen. I don't see most of those who are active on the ground in Syria, the fighting forces, mostly the Islamists and the others, would be willing to sit down in the same room with Iran, with the main power that is supporting their tormentor, mm-hmm. the regime of Bashar al-Assad. I think what the United States should do, or what the regional powers, if they are serious, really, is to, as I said, try to stop the flow of fighters going to Syria and to take some serious measures against the regime. Look, Bashar al-Assad's regime was the magnet that drew all of these forces. It was the magnet that drew all of these crazy volunteers from Europe and from the rest of the Arab world. It's his massacres that drew all of these people. But you have to give the Syrian people the hope that we learned something from the last five years of bloodletting, that the source of all the problems in Syria is that autocratic, repressive, ugly regime of Bashar al-Assad. I can tell you that it is Iran, through its proxies and through its direct help to Damascus, that saved the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. It's not Russia, it's not China, it is Iran and Hezbollah. Hezbollah is deeply involved in this sectarian war, unfortunately, that's taking place there. And now they are held as correctly as the stooges and the pawns and the proxies of Iran.
Melham argued that Iran should not be involved, and that the United States train and equip program for the moderate Syrian opposition fighters should target the Syrian regime, which caused the crisis in the first place.
Thank you, Mohammed.
Thank you, Sue, for having me.
Coming up on International Edition, China's stock market tanks, hiding on the internet, and a historic road change for country music. The Chinese stock market suffered its biggest plunge in 8 years today. VOA's Alexis Christophorus joins us on the line now. Hi, Alexis.
Hi, Susan. This latest stock crash poured cold water on investor confidence. We saw China's Shanghai Composite Index slide 8.5%, and this is despite recent unprecedented government intervention in the market. You'll remember last month, officials allowed more than 1,400 companies to halt trading. It banned major shareholders from selling stakes, and it armed a state-run financing vehicle with more than $480 billion to support the market. So this retreat we saw shattered the sense of calm that had fallen over mainland markets last week, and it raised questions over the viability of government efforts to prop up share prices as the Chinese economy slows. We got more proof of that recently. China's industrial profits fell 0.3% in June from a year earlier. That's according to the Statistics Bureau. And the International Monetary Fund has urged China to eventually unwind its support measures. But many analysts say this latest stock crash reveals the market is still too fragile without government support. Susan?
Well, thank you very much, Alexis.
You bet.
For journalists, human rights activists, and those working under repressive regimes, the internet can be a sword that cuts two ways. While it's a great tool for communicating with audiences all over the world, the web can also create new security gaps that hostile governments are all too eager to exploit. International Edition's Doug Bernard has been looking into a tool specifically created to help at-risk activists and journalists, and he's found that it might help a whole lot of other people wanting to protect their privacy online as well, and he joins me now. Hi, Doug.
Hi there.
And what have you found?
Well, I found a tool that's called TAILS. TAILS stands for the Amnesic Incognito Live System, and we'll get to what all that means in just a quick moment. But its goal was pretty simple. The developers wanted to create a tool that had really pretty good privacy, fairly bulletproof, but make it simple and easy to use. As we've talked about before, many of these privacy tools are cumbersome, they're unwieldy, and, you know, non-technical people just give up on them. So they wanted to create a tool that would allow people to communicate or conduct their business online in a secure fashion. And so what they did is they created this TAILS system.
Well, how does it work?
Well, essentially, the live system is key, the LS part of TAILS. What that means is it really just sort of lives like on a flash drive. You plug the flash drive in, and when you open it up, it opens up its own operating system, sort of like Windows or Apple operating system, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fairly basic. It's fairly simple. But what this does, and it also routes everything through the Tor network, which is a fairly robust privacy and anonymizing tool. But what this does is it creates a situation where none of the data, none of your communications are ever stored anywhere. They're only routing through your computer. They're not stored there. So if a government, say, seizes your computers, which happens a lot, or breaks in, introduces some malware to spy on you, they can't get your communications. They can't get to your sources or your supporters. So it's really sort of like a veil that you can kind of open up, almost a cloak of secrecy that you can put over your computer to conduct your business.
It also sounds like something a terrorist group could use.
Well, as with many of these tools, I mean, we talk about how good Tor is in, keeping your communications private. Of course, it all depends on how people want to use these tools. But these really were, created, I think, more for the good guys.
So how is it being used by the good guys?
In many situations. So, for example, there are a group of human rights activists charting abuses in Tibet and Uyghur, and they're using Tails to kind of document and communicate abuses as they document them. There are journalists in Pakistan who use Tails all the time because it basically kind of protects them from a suspicious government. And, if you want perhaps a recommendation, nobody lesser than Edward Snowden has insisted that anybody that he communicates with, whether it's Glenn Greenwald or whoever, be using the Tails system.
Well, thank you for coming and explaining to us a good tip that's a little complicated for those of us who are not media people like you.
And I'll just say it's free and it's available online.
Okay. Thank you, Doug.
You bet.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Ago this month, singer-songwriter Bob Dylan took the stage at Newport Folk Festival and delivered a performance that got him booed and also helped change the direction of music and culture in the United States. VOA's Eric Felton has details.
Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, or the times they are a-changing.
In the mid-1960s, the times, they were indeed a-changin'. One of the places those changes were being felt was the world of folk music, says rock historian Elijah Wald, author of a new book, Dylan Goes Electric.
There was a moment in the early 60s where you could look at the Billboard charts and 7 of the top 10 albums were folk records. And, Joan Baez, Peter, Paul, and Mary, the Kingston Trio, all had huge, huge, huge number one records.
If I had a hammer, I'd a hammer in the morning, I'd a hammer in the evening. All over
and then all that changed.
In 1964, the Beatles had hit, by 1965, by the summer of 1965, a lot of people in the folk scene were sort of feeling like their world was threatened.
They were hoping that Bob Dylan would come to the rescue. Dylan had become a legend in folk music circles, both as a powerful songwriter and a distinctive singer. Most of the crowd at the Newport Folk Festival on the evening of July 25, 1965, were expecting to hear this.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Instead, when Dylan took the stage, this is what they got. Bob Dylan had gone electric, and the folk purists didn't like it one bit. But
Dylan had always liked rock and roll, and Dylan didn't think of rock and roll as stupid music.
In fact, Dylan was a Beatles fan. He would later say that from the first time he heard the Beatles, he knew they were pointing to the direction where music had to go.
Honestly, once the Beatles hit, I think that the writing was on the wall. But when Dylan went with the Beatles on that one, that was that. That was essentially the end of the folk scene as a huge mainstream pop trend.
Beyond the music, Dylan's performance that night also marked a turning point in American culture.
Before 1965 was really a different world, and it's the 60s of the civil rights movement and of folk music and of joining arms across the generations and across the races. And after 1965, it's the world of rock. And obviously, I'm not saying Dylan created that change, but I do think that the confrontation at Newport happened because it was symbolic of that much larger confrontation and has been remembered because it really is sort of the moment of rupture where the new 60s emerged.
For VOA News, I'm Eric Felton.
Please follow us on Twitter at VOA underline IE. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to human rights organizations and Chinese activists, in recent weeks, Chinese authorities have systematically detained, arrested, subjected to forced disappearance, held incommunicado, or questioned and released 169 lawyers, legal staff, and activists involved in peacefully challenging official policies in China. Chinese authorities detained lawyers from several law firms, including six from the Beijing Feng Rei firm. The Feng Rei law firm handled a number of high-profile human rights cases, including the case of jailed Uyghur scholar Ilham Tohati. The crackdown began on July 9th when Feng Rei lawyer Wang Yu disappeared after alerting friends via a text message that her internet connection and electricity had been cut off and that people were trying to break into her home. Wang had represented several clients involved in human rights activism or religious freedom issues, including practitioners of Falun Gong, a religious group banned in China. The firm's director, Zhu Shifeng, was also detained. He had represented Zhang Miao, a Chinese journalist who'd reported on the Hong Kong democracy protests. Among those who have not been heard from since being detained is well-known lawyer Lu Heping. He represented fellow lawyer and blind activist Chen Guangcheng and helped victims of forced evictions. The United States is deeply concerned that the broad scope of China's new national security law is being used as a legal facade to commit human rights abuses. The U.S. strongly urges China to respect the rights of all its citizens and to release all those who have recently been detained for seeking to protect the rights of Chinese citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.